Previously on the Baker's Dozen podcast.
Mayfield, I could care less. He's a good player. I don't care about the guy.
Trey calls him Baker Manziel.
Baker Manziel.
We all know what Baker Mayfield is. He's a stat monster.
God, the guy is just, he's a scumbag to me. I just don't like him. Something about him just rubs me the wrong way.
The Cincinnati Bengals?
It's just one of those things. Like I said, man, like I don't want to do the chalkiest of chalk, and I don't want to put the exact same thing that you had, because my lean was Steelers, as disgusting as that is to root for a team that Tim Crumrin likes.
I do think that if we are to open Pandora's box of making direct payments to these athletes and take on all the problems that are going to come with it, these payments should be related to endorsements from the private sector, large or small. These payments should absolutely not be coming from the university.
Captivating right off the bat. There's a great cast, beautiful setting, simple plot, and it transcends from a classic whodunit crime mystery into a really complex story.
We're back with Fern. We're here to talk some more college football, but conversation just hit. Let's keep our prayers up for the limousine riding, jet flying, kiss stealing, wheeling dealing, son of a gun, only known as Ric Flair.
Kick out, brother.
Woo!
Kick out.
Break off in a little sidebar here. Do we have any first ballot Hall of Famers next year?
You know, I think that we're Chipper Jones. Chipper Jones is one of them. Old Larry, who has more illegitimate children than World Series rings.
I've been a Donald Glover fan for a while now. So seeing him in that, in a new role, something a little bit edgier, trying to kind of make a statement in there, I was sold right off the get-go.
As for yours truly, well, humble, that's where I'm going to go. Because I won.
And for the record, I would have signed a contract at 18 for two kegs of beer.
With the absence of Mayweather over the past year or so, everybody's been trying to figure out who is the best pound-for-pound fighter in the sport. And there's Chocolatito Gonzalez, there's Triple G, there's Kovalev, there's Crawford, Lomachenko, and Andre Ward.
People need to calm down on Sterling Shepard. He was carted off, sprained ankle.
Yeah, he cried, though, so.
Also kind of started to... And that's Bo.
Shout out to the cat. That's 2 weeks in a row. We're keeping that. Army, national champion?
Kind of liking the USC pick earlier.
Yeah, dude.
With Heather interrupting my pick, I just changed it, actually.
Oh, no.
I just changed it from USC.
Previously on, warning.
I just changed it from USC to Alabama. Oh. I'm going to go chalk again because it seems like your chalk was better than my chalk. So now I'm going to take Alabama to win the national championship.
My 2018 national champion is the Alabama Crimson Tide. Wait, are we live right now? Come on.
We need time you can put 70s LA porn, politics, and
ass kicking,
and great dialogue between a lot of these characters. I'm a big fan of.
It's a new dawn. It's a new day. It's a new life for me. Yeah, it's a new dawn. It's a new day. New life for me, ooh, 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 ooh. And I'm feeling good.
Honestly, it's pretty hard to believe that I've recorded over 115 total episodes right here at the Baker's Dozen podcast. I mean, the numbers add up, 13 episodes for season 1, 3 for season 2, and another 13 for season 3. And that had me near a half century's worth when you figured there were Special Edition, Quick Hit, and even the Rise to the Challenge episodes along the way. You add in another 60 plus when you count season 4, our latest pop-up summer season, and a collection of Money Problems episodes with a ton of college football and NFL picks over 2 seasons. You also have to include a new series, 10 Minute Parking, and suddenly you have a huge mashup of sports and pop culture commentary featured over the last couple of years. To be honest, it's been quite the ride since we kicked things off, all the way back in March of 2015. Think about it, where were you March 10th, 2015? I was starting a podcast. Almost 2.5 years later, bought my first house with my beautiful wife. We're married, we had our honeymoon. I've been teaching now for 10 years, I've been coaching for 10 years. And despite a few bumps in the production quality and a couple delays in the road, taking time off to recalibrate, we're still going strong here at the Baker's Dozen Podcast. And I'm damn proud of the work we've done over the last 2.5 years. My name is River City Clement, and I have the privilege of saying that I'm the creator, executive producer, head writer, and host right here at the Baker's Dozen Podcast. But I also need to say that the guests that I have on this show and the support I receive in this household, none of that's important. This best of episode affords me the opportunity to reflect on the tremendous guests, the amazing laughs, the great times I've had these past 4+ seasons. There have been a ton of laughs along the way, incredible insight, I've learned a lot from some of these tremendous guests, and tons of support along the way as well. So to close out this sort of hybrid pop-up summer season, I want to look back at this summer, as well as everything featured in our previous stellar fourth season, which was mainly last year, before we head on to what's next. And logically, that's got to be season 5. The great part is we started off this episode with some of my favorite previously on clips, just showing some of the laughs and great times and incredible insight we've had over this run. But for more in-depth interviews, stories, predictions, reviews, suggestions, interactions with guests, the heart of every true episode of this show, that's what you're going to hear for the rest of the show. And whether you're catching some of these for the first time, the second time, or you're a loyal listener, I hope you keep listening, because it's some of the best of what we have to offer. I know I enjoyed listening to these clips again. It was a lot of fun. To be honest, they symbolize what's best about this show. It's not about my opinion. It's not about me. It's about spending time with friends who share a common interest with me. And whether we agree on something or not, it's always fun. All we're doing is just having a conversation. It's no different than sitting on somebody's deck, sitting together at a bar watching a game, or just having a conversation in a car ride. Whether it's sports or pop culture, look, I'll go toe-to-toe with any podcast, radio show, TV show, sports personality when it comes to bringing on guests who are both knowledgeable, personable, and just enjoyable to listen to. Seriously, I'll throw down that gauntlet anytime. This may be a local podcast based out of Richmond, Virginia that gets anywhere from 50 to 500 listeners on a good week, but it doesn't mean that I'm not trying to do my very best, and my guests are absolutely bringing their absolute... And my guests are bringing their A game to bring you the most varied and unique perspective out there. We know what we're talking about. Some of these guests won't brag about themselves, but I will. They're tremendous. So with that, the positivity flowing, let's roll some clips and enjoy the very best of season 4 and the pop-up summer season right here with yours truly, River City Clement, at the Baker's Dozen Podcast. And for our final segment, some quick hit questions with follow-ups by me to each debater. The question is not given in advance, and I'm going to follow up. Jimmy, one of the things that you talked about was contracts, and that scares the hell out of me. What on earth are we going to do with the fact that hundreds and hundreds of athletes at each school are going to need to negotiate contracts as 17-year-olds? How is this going to be paid for? How is this going to be done fairly? And how do we not end up with thousands of D1 athletes already in debt for lawyer fees the first day they start at their school?
That's a really good question, man. There's no really other way to put it except for these kids are almost going to be betting on themselves. People aren't going to like to hear it, but you know, when you brought in the negotiation point of it, there's going to have to be agents and stuff involved like that, and kind of like how they're involved right now. They enter agreements with these these agents, you know, based off contingency plans that they are going to get to the draft and they are going to get drafted. I think it's just one of those necessary evils that has to get done in order for these kids to come out with a fair shake here.
While there's never a guarantee that an athlete is going to be drafted where they believe they are, that they're going to reach the contract level that they think they are, typically when you hire an agent to join the draft, you're expecting a contract. There is little to no guarantee, even for the top athletes, that they might face injury. There's little to no guarantee that 3 or 4 years from then, after their contract is over, that they're going to be a desirable entity to the NFL draft or the NBA draft or the Major League draft. So my question to you is, how on earth can you guarantee these kids are going to be able to pay this back? Or are you just adding to their debt ceiling by saying, you know, I hope in 3 years you're going to be drafted. You need to bet on yourself, barring injury, academic struggles, or perhaps being dropped on the depth chart.
Well, hopefully these kids, while they're in school, they do go through and they get that contract. They're in school. They're doing the right thing. They're doing what they're supposed to do. And that's this contract acts as a lot of people like to bring it up. It's essentially going to be a scholarship. Like I said earlier, there'll be contingency plans and verbiage in that contract where they have to hold up their end of the bargain as far as academics go while they're in that school. These are some of the top academic schools in the nation that these kids go out there and play really good sports for. So hopefully they're in there doing what they're supposed to do. And they're going to school. And if, you know, God forbid something happens to this kid, he can't play football anymore. He holds up his end of the bargain as far as academics go. He's going to get a really good education out of it, and he's going to get a great job that he can provide for himself and his family down the road when he gets out of there.
Yeah, I just want to add to your point, Clement, or your question about, you know, how are these players going to afford these lawyers? It's another good example of why these players should unionize. If they do that, everybody pays in a little bit of union dues. That Players Association hires lawyers to represent these players going forward with their, you know, with their contracts with the universities.
And for the record, I would have signed a contract at 18 for 2 kegs of beer.
It's absolutely fantastic. There's nothing I could say about that. Smiley Kaufman would be proud. All right, Trey, your final question. According to a 2011 survey conducted by the NCAA, the average student athlete spends 43 hours a week at their sport and 38 hours on academics. That is an 81-hour work week, which is far more challenging than most full-time jobs. Look, it's well established that they cannot also have outside jobs or internships once you enter into an athletic agreement. Trey, student athletes aren't afforded the same class schedule that full-time students can get. How do you justify an 80-hour work week in a $6 billion industry and no chance to earn any revenue off of yourself?
I love that we're comparing playing sports to a work week. I personally still play sports, and I pay people money so that I can play sports. I work a 45, 46-hour work week every single week. I try to play as many sports as I can, and I love it. I wouldn't trade it for the world. So the fact that these guys have to play sports and we consider it work, I mean, high school kids do the same thing all the time. Might not be the same amount of numbers, but high school kids still put in the amount of work that some college teams do.
I just real quick wanted to shout out Crucial Taunt. We're coming for that spring championship next year for sure.
We're going to do it in the fall too. You know what? That is a fantastic point, and I am never going to shortchange how hard you work, the amount of hours that you work, and that you're underpaid for doing it. But when you play football and you do pay to do it and you love it and you work hard at it and you train for it, you prep for it, there are not 100,000 people in the stands watching Crucial Taunt games. I wish there were. There should be. There are not ESPN River City Sports, you know, segments that are being going on with huge ad rates. College football games, the average attendance is going to be above 50,000 if you're looking at a major Division I school. You're thinking about all the revenue that's being made off of jerseys. I wish somebody made a Trey Fernandez jersey. I'd wear it. But Dalvin Cook, he can't make money off of jerseys with his number. Johnny Manziel can't make money off of t-shirts or hats with his number or his likeness on there. What's the justification for these athletes that have this type of revenue being produced? How do you justify all this money because of what they're doing and they still don't see a dime?
This is the same argument we've been having the whole time. It's more about the money than the players. Everybody's mad that all this money's coming in. We still have to remember, too, there is a name on the front of the jersey as well, the school. It's not always about the player. Some people buy jerseys because they actually like the team. Also, this goes back to the high school argument. High school players wear uniforms. They wear apparel. They sell high school apparel. Coaches get paid. Tickets get sold at a much lower level, but does that not mean that they're not entitled to some kind of money? It's the exact same thing, just on a much lower scale.
And our final question goes to Brett. Now, this is not an economics-based podcast, so I'm going to throw something out there. $6 billion industry, the NCAA. How is it, Brett, that we can't justify spending between $50 and $150 million out of that to find even a low-level stipend for players? Money can be allocated, but you mean to tell me that less than 5% of that income can't be spent on paying the players for what they feel they've earned?
Yeah, it's a good question. To be honest, I would just personally prefer that money go to financial aid, more scientists, more teachers, more better facilities, more labs, more research, things to make society a better place. As I've stated, I personally feel like these guys are already getting paid, most of them, free education, world-class university. I mean, that's just a dream come true. It would be for, you know, 99% of the population of the world.
My final thought is that I sometimes wonder if I am simultaneously shortchanging the incredible education that these students are being offered, especially since many of these athletes would never be afforded this education based on their academic standing in high school. Devil's advocate for me says that these players, they are in a high demand industry, and they are the only high demand industry that I can think of above 18 that do not have a chance to earn part of the revenue that they've helped earn.
With this opening 4+ days of, you know, night and day action, Trey, what are some of the things that really came to your mind this first real weekend of college football?
Some of the things that stuck out to me were the non-conference games, just the amount of them. It reminded me of bowl season. There were just so many good matchups, came one after the other. Just a great start to college football weekend.
It really was, and I think there were so many highs that you really didn't notice some of the disappointments that came through the week. I know something that we talked about early in the day was the fact that we were wondering if it was a good idea to take USC, and not just to take USC to cover the spread, but maybe to pull the upset. And you watch that first quarter and you start thinking, does Alabama have anything at quarterback? And then all of a sudden you blink and Alabama's up by 3 touchdowns, end up winning the game by 40+ points. Is Alabama just that good?
Alabama is the scariest team in the country right now, hands down. I mean, they can go and wipe the floor with USC. imagine what they can do to the rest of the country.
If Jalen Hurts is for real as a freshman quarterback, I think he was third on the depth chart. That's absolutely terrifying. Somebody that Nick Saban trusts at quarterback, it seems like they might not have to manage the game at the position. I mean, all credit to guys like Jay Coker, but if you've got a quarterback that can step up and make huge plays in and out of the pocket, you've got some of the best receivers like Calvin Ridley in the country. You look at Bo Scarborough, you look at some of those young running backs. Do you think that Alabama's going to cakewalk their way through the schedule?
I honestly don't see them losing a game. I mean, Alabama, let's be real here, never really has a quarterback. I mean, they have decent players playing there. It's not the quarterback that wins the game. It's the entire team. They're just stacked at every position.
You could see USC, even with short fields, couldn't even try testing the ball deep downfield. You know, one of the things that we were talking about were some of those teams that always seem to be on the periphery, your Tennessees, your Oklahomas, your UCLAs. Well, Tennessee escaped on Thursday, but was far from impressive against Appy State at home. Butch Jones, you know, if you're a Tennessee fan, I know that you're the furthest thing from that, but if you're looking at this from volunteer eyes, what are you thinking right now?
I would be shaking in my boots if I was Tennessee. I mean, you got to win this weekend, that's for sure, and the schedule doesn't get any easier. And I'll tell you what, Georgia looked great against North Carolina. That quarterback came in and played a phenomenal game against them.
Well, Grayson Lambert's not the answer. Nick Eason is the future of this program. Kind of looks like every Georgia quarterback you've ever seen. You know, if only had a name like Houston or something like that that would make it stand out. Oklahoma, big game Bob. You know, they go to Houston. They're pretty much playing at Houston, you know, in Reliant Stadium. Were you surprised to see Oklahoma get manhandled like that?
Absolutely not. I pick against Oklahoma every year, but they seem to do the same thing every year. They lose early, and then they'll blow it when they get there late. I mean, it happens every single year.
I know Josh Rosen is somebody that was pretty high on your Heisman list, and then all of a sudden just lays an egg against Myles Garrett and Texas A&M. Is this who UCLA is, or do you think that they can still make noise in the Pac-12?
The Pac-12 is kind of wide open to me. I mean, especially after watching USC get destroyed as well. They didn't look that great. Rosen also was running for his life. I mean, that guy didn't have a chance to throw the ball. And he did make a few impressive plays still. Yeah, that looked rough against A&M. And more surprising to me was how good A&M looked rather than how bad UCLA looked.
I think we forget that Trevor Knight is that guy that did beat Alabama in that Sugar Bowl. He hasn't had a moment outside of the Katy Perry love on game day, but, you know, maybe the offensive coordinator they picked up from UCLA, no less, was a good thing. You know, UCLA, to their credit, did rally furiously in the fourth quarter, falling short in overtime. It was one of those situations where I was a little bit surprised. If we're going to talk about this weekend, I think Sunday night was the game of the week. It's going to be one of the games of the year between Notre Dame and Texas. I know that you are not a Notre Dame fan, but you typically root for them. I think you kind of agree with me that college football is better when Notre Dame's good and they're relevant. That game, in your opinion, take Notre Dame out of the national playoff consideration? Or do you think, like a typical team that loses in week one, Notre Dame can come back?
Notre Dame can come back. I mean, they still play a lot of hard teams on their schedule. So, I mean, they can make some moves as far as where the polls are at. We really needed that Texas win if they were planning on moving on.
And if we were to talk about Texas with Charlie Strong and Shane Bruchel and Tyrone Swoops, do you think Texas is on the way back? Do you think that Texas is back? You know, where do you see the Longhorns being at this point?
I like Charlie Strong a lot as a coach, so it was good to see them win. Do I necessarily think they're back, though? Not sold yet. Conference as a whole, nobody in the conference really scares me enough to where I don't think Texas is irrelevant, but they definitely have to keep winning all their out-of-conference games.
One thing that I want to talk about quickly is it happens every year. You can depend on certain things. Death, taxes, and the New England Patriots. 23-21 win over Arizona. Scoring late, holding off a late drive, and the superhuman heroics nearly of Larry Fitzgerald. How on earth are people still not understanding how good the New England Patriots are?
I'm not sure. It's like you said, they come in there, no Tom Brady, no Rob Gronkowski. They pretty much gave Arizona their best pass rusher from last year in Chandler Jones. And these guys still come in there, Belichick and company, come in and get the job done. I don't know when people are going to start giving these guys credit. All I took away from that is that if the New England Patriots open up as a betting dog and that line gets worse as the bettors continue to not believe in the New England Patriots, bet the house on the Patriots. Because I think that line jumped up to something stupid like 9.5 or 10 points.
It was at 9.5 at kickoff after being at a preposterous 6.5 with Gronkowski healthy. It's as if Jimmy Garoppolo wasn't going to be able to take a snap.
It's unbelievable. And they pretty much, McDaniels, Belichick, and everybody, they came out there and they put the kid in a confident situation. They let him throw the ball. Like you said, I don't know when people are going to just start to not doubt the New England Patriots and Bill Belichick as a organization, but they need to wake up soon because it's coming.
concerning the Oakland Raiders. Early in the fourth quarter, they looked like they were going to be the biggest disappointment of week one. 15 minutes later, Jack Del Rio is national news for making what I think needs to be a decision that's made far more often. That's on the road, going for two. First things first, it obviously sounds like you agree with Del Rio. What are the thoughts that are going through your head at the bar when you see the Raiders make that decision? And is this a galvanizing moment? Is this the moment that's going to define who the Raiders are for this season? A team that many have as a dark horse to make the playoffs in the AFC.
My initial thought was, man, you gotta love sports. I mean, this is week one of the NFL, a high-scoring shootout of a game that pretty much everybody expected it to be that way. And like you said, when you're Del Rio, it's week one. I don't think it's going to set the tone for the entire season, but it definitely doesn't get it out on the wrong foot. I agree with what you're saying as well. I think more coaches in the NFL, it's a copycat league. A lot of guys will go for the tie right there and play for overtime. I don't understand why he would have done that. He made the right choice in going for two. You take the ball out of Drew Brees' hand, who's been absolutely carving you up the entire afternoon. You got the ball on the 3-yard line to win the football game. You got Derek Carr. You got Michael Crabtree, Amari Cooper. Why not? I love it.
Well, it's almost time to wrap things up, which I hate to say, but there's still one major issue, the biggest issue at hand to address, and that's obviously predictions. All right, gentlemen, who is going to win the 41st Ryder Cup, and what will the final score be? No real analysis needed, unless you want to throw in a few thoughts, just the championship team. And remember to everybody listening, the U.S. must win by a half point. A tie goes to the Europeans. Jimmy, you're up first. Who wins, and what is the final tally?
Final tally, 2016 Ryder Cup at Hazeltine, 15.5, 12.5, the United States of America. After a singles day, Sunday charge by the Stars and Stripes, winning putt, getting sunk by the 2016 Player of the Year, Dustin Johnson.
Chris Johnson, what do you got? He held up some paper during that. That was a good moment.
I am also going 15.5 U.S. to 12.5 Europe. I don't think it's going to come down to the end. I think the U.S. is going to get an early lead, and Europe's going to limp in and get some points there at the end to kind of make it closer.
That's two for America. Mr. Needham?
Let's make it three. I think the lack of experience with six Ryder Cup rookies will hurt the Euros. My sentimental side says USA will find some extra motivation in the passing of the king, Arnold Palmer. USA pulls it out on a close one, 14.5, 13.5.
Most people that listen to this show are not going to be surprised by my prediction, and I almost want to forget about the Palmer passing. I hope it makes an impact. It's almost impossible to pick against the United States. Davis Love III is not the right captain for this team. The Bubba Watson situation is going to be a distraction. I don't like 10 veterans and 2 rookies on this team. I think that guys like Justin Thomas and Daniel Berger could have been big selections for this team. I think that we're going to have to purge our program. 14-14, the Europeans retain on a ridiculous rule. The Europeans retain on a rule that is going to enrage America, because right now, look at the landscape around us. Things are just on fire. It's the most clement pick in the world, and nobody hopes they're wrong more than me. I'm going to take the Europeans, and I'm going to do it begrudgingly.
I just want to jump in, and I know he has to do it. You got to add some variety here.
You got to get ratings.
But all three of us just looked at each other, shook our heads in one of the most clement situations we've ever been a part of right there. Oh, the RJ. That, God, need him.
The reverse jinx. The reverse jinx has to happen during the tournament.
Hit the nail on the head. But all those listeners out there, if you have Craigslist, pay attention. I will be posting a Craigslist ad with Clement's phone number on it saying that he's giving away puppies.
Maybe this is just the stink of the Ryan Fitzpatrick 6 interception game. Throwing him under the bus. It's just Clement speak. It's just what I do. The reverse jinx. This is why you need to follow me on Twitter, because you will find them pretty much every game that I'm watching. Hashtag RJ. Hashtag reverse jinx.
Hashtag RIP Ryan Fitzpatrick.
Gentlemen, I cannot thank you enough for all of you being in the studio right now. This just turned out 50 times better than I thought it would. I'm going to say this. We said it before. Shout out to Tim Crumrine. Tim was supposed to be a part of this. He did his research. I talked to him about
it.
Tim got married this past Sunday. We love the guy. We are so proud of him. He will be back to talk golf. You know, this is a guy that is desperate to win one of our, you know, major championship challenges. I got two of the winners right here in this room with me. Although I get to be the major champion picker of the year because I won two of them, right? That sounds pretty fair. I also had two champions.
I know. I certainly don't deserve to talk about it.
Jimmy's going to stop drafting his team in a car. No more rental car picks. Gentlemen, thank you so much for coming to the studio, spending your Tuesday night with me. And I'll say this. I am so excited for this Ryder Cup, and I want nothing more than for you guys to just
berate me with giffies and just as many text messages berating me for picking the Europeans to win in the most clement way possible.
Absolutely. Really fast before we get done with this, man. Just we've touched on it a couple of times. We lost Arnold Palmer. Another guy, too, that we lost on Sunday. Jose Fernandez, pitcher for the Miami Marlins. Clement and I talked about it real fast. I don't think we can remember such a loss in our generation that meant so much about an athlete just taken so soon before its prime. 24 years old, man, the guy had his way into Cooperstown, you know, down the line, and that's just really tough to swallow there. So rest in peace, Jose.
One of the best quotes I heard, and we're going to close out the show with this. Arnold Palmer was a constellation. Jose Fernandez was a comet. They both burn brightly, and we're going to miss them. Thanks for listening. Now we're going to go to TV, and we're going to look at the hottest new show on TV, the show that if you're around me, I'm telling people to watch. And I love that Heather and I watch it. It's kind of an eclectic view, and that's Atlanta on FX. We recently started the comedy drama series, which is created and starring Donald Glover. A lot of you know him from Community. He was a writer on 30 Rock. His rap alter ego is Childish Gambino. We're 4 episodes in now. What are your early thoughts on Atlanta on FX?
Honestly, I think it's really real. It's a really real show, but it's also very simple in the stories that are told. And it's really funny. I don't think that was something that I was expecting from it. And to be able to pull off things that are so real, so relatable, but also make it funny, that's a hard thing to do, but it's executed very well.
I think our favorite episode was an episode that we all can sort of can understand, in which Glover is dead broke and he goes on this date and he ends up basically, you know, getting bamboozled by the waitress to order this special and this dessert. And I love when he looks at her and he just goes, "You're killing me.
Yeah.
You're killing me." And I tell you, he has this likability factor that I think a lot of people are really starting to embrace with Glover. What about him makes this show so good? Why, obviously, his voice and his performance, but why is Glover's stamp on this show part of the reason why it's so successful?
He's so magnetic. You really can't take your eyes off of him when he's acting in a scene. And I think, I mean, at least I do really sympathize with his character, Earn. While he's unintentionally funny, like you just mentioned, that little quip that he had to the waitress, you don't find him trying to force this funny, but it turns out to be pretty humorous. And he can also show you a really dramatic side, and that's really powerful. He's also slowly revealing elements to his character during every show, so it's kind of like, what's gonna happen next?
Don't you love that, how they're not just telling you everything right away? Like, he seems to be like a Princeton dropout, but we're not really sure the story behind that, what he was in school for. I love the cast. Paperboy, that is a type of role that has so much depth to it. You know, there's a scene in which he's basically trying to not let a kid emulate rappers and use guns. The mother shows up yelling at him, and then all of a sudden the mother realizes, oh, this guy's like a little YouTube sensation. I got to get a picture with this guy. Mm-hmm. And Keith Stanfield is Darius. He really came out in the 4th episode I saw it, when they were sort of doing this swap, you know, type deal. And he was in a great movie that we watched, Short Term 12, with Brie Larson and Rami Malek. I mean, these are some of the future stars of Hollywood. And Zazie Beetz, Vanessa, she's beautiful. And she's just, I think magnetic is the perfect word. They have this relationship that seems so authentic. That's what I love about the show. And I think one of the things that we both really enjoy about the show is the social commentary that you see. Sometimes it's really subtle. We saw that with a lot of different types of people being addressed in a very important prison sort of lobby scene. And then it was kind of beaten over the head a little bit talking about Instagram culture last episode. Do you like that this is a show that wants to tackle social issues overtly?
I do. And I think that goes back to thinking about it as a real show. It's things that you see in society, and I think that's what makes it so appealing. How many people can relate to financial troubles and wanting more out of life? I think a lot of people can put themselves in those people's shoes.
It's one of the things that Glover has, is that he seems authentic. It seems like it's a story that you believe. It's not zany. It's not just trying to find a quick laugh. You know, my last thought on the show is something that's been pretty popular with a lot of reviews for the show, is that it's a 30-minute comedy. It's a 22-minute show with commercials. Do you enjoy a shorter show? It seems like the push has been for these hour-long heavy dramas or really dark comedies.
I do. You know me, I need my breaks. So I enjoy that format for TV, especially a short comedy-based show. It's more appealing to me just personally.
Well, the next show we're going to talk about, if we're going to make a dramatic shift change, it's going to be going from Atlanta to Columbia in the late 80s and early 90s, when the drug wars were really at their peak. So we look at Narcos, you know, which is going through its second season on Netflix. Explain to us why you enjoy watching Narcos and why it can blend being kind of a mindless, entertaining view. But also, I feel like you're watching Wikipedia because you're learning so much along the way.
I'm a history guy, teach history. And while I don't teach the drug cartels in the 1980s,
if it's only
so hard to separate pop culture from the history, from the influence that you still see today, both in current events and the media. And it's just, it's a real, does such a great job of blending what is majority true with a little bit of, you know, artistic license.
Absolutely.
With the artistic license of adding the fiction in there, but keeping it engaging. You cross-check what they're actually, what was going on at the time. And that show pretty much nails it most of the time. They take make up a few people, combine a few people, but you can learn a lot while both being really, really entertained by this great show.
Well, it's the benefit of watching a show that's based on real life connections. I mean, if anybody watched the Emmys on Sunday, the new movement in television is going to be real life connected shows. It's going to be The People versus O.J. Simpson. It's this movement towards JonBenet Ramsey stories. It's going to be ripped from the headlines, and not in a Law and Order sense, but in a let's look at this actual story and let's take a take from that and look at a unique perspective. Here's my question to you. Netflix renewed this show for 2 more seasons. Neither of us have finished season 2. I'm about a quarter of the way through. Can this show exist without Pablo Escobar?
I'm a little apprehensive. The show revolves around him. You've got to know the cast of characters. The actors who play them, especially the guy who plays Pablo Escobar, is just phenomenal.
By the way, this guy did not know Spanish, grew up with Portuguese, learns it for this role, and he says he struggles with his weight because he's not typically a heavier guy. So he's got to get into a pretty manic character. I think it's Wagner or Mora. He is phenomenal. Do you think the show can exist without him? Or do they have to make a whole dynamic shift and get away from Pablo's story, perhaps?
They've earned my trust. If they're going to do it, if they're going to keep the show going, I want to see a reset. I want to see them go a new direction, stick with the Narcos idea, but change locations, change time. Let's see some new people and don't try to drag out a storyline that's been beat to death or shot to death.
Exactly. Well, and the drug story exists outside of Colombia. I mean, there are drug lords in all sort of different perspectives and locations. I know that you've talked to me about El Chapo and how great that would be to see some of the major events of his life, a story that's actually ongoing that could really be ripped from the headlines.
Yeah, you have another guy who makes these Forbes billionaire lists with how much money he's making on illegal drug trade.
It's amazing.
Who, you know, I would, if they reset, that's where I want to see it go. It doesn't have to be El Chapo, the Mexican drug lord, but somebody like that. There's so much good stuff out there to work with, so many interesting stories that are both already completed or ones that are still going on, like we just mentioned.
It makes it a limited series, and it makes it almost like an American Horror Story type shift every season, probably a little bit higher quality, that you can look at new stories.
You know, unfortunately, the news that has really dominated the story for baseball this year is surrounding tragedy, not the promise of something like the Atlanta Braves. Or, you know, even David Ortiz's unbelievable last season.
Yeah.
And that was the news that we learned last Sunday morning with the tragic passing of Jose Fernandez, who at 24 already looked like a future Hall of Famer for the Miami Marlins. It's almost impossible to process something like this, especially as fans outside of the Miami community. You know, share some thoughts that you have. You know, you've seen Fernandez pitch a little bit more than most, being a Braves fan. But also, you know, we as fans, we take this stuff harder than most people think.
Yeah, I think... Well, my first reaction to it was that it was, you know, if you look at like tragic sports deaths, it's right there with like your Reggie Lewis's, your Dale Earnhardt's. Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where I will remember where I was when I found out. And I can't say that for a lot of situations like that. Remember exactly where I was standing, exactly what I was doing. And I think one of the things that makes it so much more devastating is, if you look at his background, like getting out of Cuba, like just as unlikely as everything in his life was, for his career and his life to end the way it did, it's all the more, and not saying it would be better if it was a guy who'd been born into privilege in the U.S., because obviously it wouldn't, but man, for a guy who overcome so much and played with such joy, I mean, he's a guy who just, I remember very distinctly against the Braves, hit his first career home run, flipped the bat, kind of admired the home run a little bit, leading to a hilarious Brian McCann instigated brawl.
What a surprise.
There are no other kinds of Braves brawls.
Or Brian McCann brawls.
Yeah, or Brian McCann. But a guy who was just fun to watch.
He loved baseball. Yeah. You could tell that he had a passion for the sport that was almost unequaled at his age and at his talent level.
Yeah. It just sucks. It sucks.
I'm glad you said that, because that's really what you want. You almost want to just be like, how can this happen? Like such talent, such promise, overcoming so many obstacles and doing it with a smile on his face. Somebody who had every reason to resent where he was, becoming a natural citizen, you know, embracing the English language at a young age. How many guys live here and never embrace our culture, our language, anything but our money? And it's amazing to see how much he cared and just the relationship with his family. Anybody close to their grandparents, you watch that video with him and his grandma and you see a love that is almost unequaled.
Yeah, and being a legit Cuban superstar in the middle of Miami, there's something to be said for that too. Like, and that's, you know, any population that doesn't often get a chance to have local heroes, getting the chance to get a local hero is someone that you always root for. And that the D. Gordon moment from the next game.
That's one of the best five moments in baseball history for me.
It was absolutely unbelievable.
More that everybody wants to know about. MVP. We had our first ever unanimous winner last year. Second win in a row for Steph Curry. It's going to be tough for him to win a third one. Who is your MVP?
I'm going to go with King James. LeBron James. It's LeBron. No other reason.
That's the perfect reason to put it.
You win in Cleveland. It's hard to win in Cleveland.
Yeah.
LeBron James.
Don't you think that last year's win is going to make people sort of appreciate more what he does? I think sometimes people take him for granted and they forget just how vital he is as a piece on that team. And I think it was fun to fall in love with the Splash Brothers and Steph Curry. And admittedly, they won 73 games last year, but LeBron's a grinder. LeBron's the guy that's doing it on both sides of the floor. We saw Steph Curry get exposed on defense. I think LeBron's going to win his fifth MVP, and I think it might just be unanimous just to say, hey, our bad for giving the first ever unanimous award to a 6'2" point guard.
Yes, I agree. And if you look at the last 2-3 minutes of that game, the last game, I mean, the one play that summed up LeBron James. Guy comes down on a fast break. This man came out of nowhere. I didn't even see him pin the shot on the glass. That was phenomenal. I mean, I did not see him coming.
That's the signature moment of the finals. More than Kyrie's jumper, it has to be LeBron. Although, could you imagine if LeBron threw that dunk down he got fouled on at the end of the game? That would have just blown up the Oracle Arena.
Yeah, you saw people getting up and walking out right then and there.
Is there anything else Ronda Rousey needs to do after this fight, in your opinion? Is this likely her coronation, or do you feel that the result of this fight will dictate her future decisions in the octagon or outside of it?
It'll definitely dictate, you know, and I think the biggest, you know, comparison you can make between her and Conor McGregor, when Conor lost to Nate Diaz, he took it very well, you know, in the cage. He gave respect to his opponent and said, let's circle back and let's do this again. Rousey lost in, you know, devastating fashion as well and disappeared for a year. So two different mindsets. I think if Rousey loses this fight, this will be her last fight in the octagon. I can't see her fighting again after this. If she does win the belt back, then it gets interesting because the question is, does she fight Cyborg at 140, which would be a bad matchup for her? Does Miesha Tate get a third fight with her, or do they give the rightful person, Julianna Pena, a shot? The thing that a lot of folks want to see is a Rousey-Holm rematch, but Holm is not going to get a title fight coming off two consecutive losses. So you would have to see Rousey win the belt, win a fight, and you have to probably see Holm win one or two fights after that to have the possibility of seeing that rematch.
Alabama goes down 7-0, and then all of a sudden it's 54-16. It's their third straight SEC title. Is it Alabama and everybody else in the playoff, or can this team be beat?
Any team can be beaten, and I want to say that for the record. I think Alabama can lose. If you watch the SEC championship game, the offense sputtered for the majority of the first half. Defense scored the majority of the points. They have a freshman quarterback, and they haven't played any close games besides the LSU game in Death Valley. The problem with all this is, though, not so much the chinks in the armor that Alabama has, but more so, can the team score on that defense? Also, can the defense keep their offense in check? I'm not so much sure if you can hold Alabama the way some of these teams have been able to do. Florida's defense is great, and they still scored on Florida's defense.
And I mean, Scarborough and company were gashing that team, and you can't make mistakes against Alabama. And Deshaun Watson and JT Barrett, they make mistakes. I hate to admit it. They're both uber talented, but it seems like the best way to beat Alabama is to play a flawless game. Clemson did it last year in the title game, and then an onside kick surprises them. It just seems like it is Alabama a class ahead.
does Alabama have to beat themselves, or do you think a team can beat them straight up with their A-plus game?
Absolutely. Alabama has to kind of mess up throughout the game for anybody to have a chance. Like you said, I'm not giving Washington much hope here, but if Ohio State or Clemson, whoever comes out of that game alive, plays their best game, Alabama plays a poor game, you might have the chance to win that game in the end. And I'm not leaving it out of the realm of possibilities for that maybe to happen.
A lot of people thought that last year, and look what Clemson. We are here with Brett and Trey in the studio for our first ever, the first of many to come, Bowl Mania specials. I couldn't be more excited. Gentlemen, you're sharing a mic. Welcome to the show.
Bowl Mania, baby. Let's fire it up.
I'm ready to go, Clement.
I know you guys are pumped. It's the first day of Bowl Mania, so while a few of you might only get a few picks that you have to change up, trust me, this is going to help you. We're talking to two-time champs and a guy that wins a lot of bronze medals. So let's start with a little bit of Bowl Mania history. You know, it's been a part of you guys, I've been a part of it for the last 3 years, but this is a storied tradition that goes back several years among a close group of friends. How did this league ultimately get started for you guys?
I'm going to go ahead and take this one. I started this league with a bunch of guys, and it was basically just a lot of arguments going on about who's the best at picking games. I mean, that's what it was. And we fought for many years now. The winner gets a delicious Cuban sandwich.
And the name of the league is Quest for the Cuban. What's the story behind that?
Well, it's the Bailey's Cuban sandwich is where it all started. And this is the most coveted sandwich on the menu, the most coveted of all the sandwiches on the menu. You got roasted pork, honey glazed ham, thinly sliced pickle, little yellow mustard. It's just the best the Cubans have done, and it's fantastic. That's the prize for winning.
Well, the only problem is Bailey's, you know, a tradition that used to be in the greater Richmond area, has now closed down. Even its newest incantation closed down after about 2 weeks. We snuck in a fantasy draft. I think we broke the restaurant. What's next? What is it? Still a Cuban from somewhere else? Is it a grill steak and cheese? You know, I think it should be the Quest for the tuna water. You know, we can go to Subway.
Quest for the tuna melt. I don't know, man.
We don't know where to go, actually. I mean, we actually haven't given out the prize in a couple years now. I think we just get together and drink beer, which kind of adds to the aura of the Quest for the Cuban, because there is no Cuban. So that.
Sort of that mythical quest, you
it's
know.
It's a mythical quest.
I'd like to hear what maybe your followers think. Maybe they've got a recommendation for a good sandwich or a good prize to top off this great competition.
As long as Tim Crumrine doesn't pick it, I'm down.
All right.
You know, a guest that's been on this show before, Drew Kizemore, Kissy. I heard his bowl ban lifted? You know, he did not come to the celebration of a past champion.
He is still serving a bowl ban. We've thought about reinstating him several times, but it might be a death penalty on our hands.
A little SMU, I mean, okay.
It's a lot going on with that. It comes to a group meeting, I would say.
Yeah, I think we'd have to take a vote on that. The story behind that is Drew didn't show up for the champions dinner to buy Colin. He was the first the winner of the first year. We all got together and got him as Cuban, and Drew didn't show up, so we decided that it's death penalty.
I really can't disagree with that.
But it might be time to revisit his case. I mean, it's been quite a few years. Let's maybe consider getting this guy back in there. I miss Kissy.
Yeah, I miss him too.
Well, you both have won March Madness, but there's something special about Bowl Mania, especially as we're now 40-plus bowls. Fern, I'm going to start with you. You're a two-time champion. When you're not winning, you're typically the runner-up. It's gone down to multiple times in title game matchups between the two of you. What's your overall strategy that you've used to take home two championship wins for Capital One's Bowl Mania Challenge?
The strategy I use is basically you put all your marbles on one team and you ride and die with that team. You're going to pick somebody that you don't think a lot of other people are taking in your pool and basically hope they win. I mean, you put your most confident points on a team that you think has a chance to win and your opponents probably aren't going to pick.
Well, I'll be curious to see if we find that team this year. Maybe it's a Western Michigan. I know Jimmy Wright's big on them this year, not necessarily for points, but for taking them outright. Brett, you are our defending champion.
That's
You've won
right.
two of the last three, and you've been the runner-up when you weren't. What is your strategy? Is it similar to Fern's, or do you take a 180 and take a different approach?
I'm hungry for another Cuban sandwich. Let's go. Back-to-back. Might be coming up this year. I still can't rack my brain around what the heck it is. So, Jack, you're killing me here. What is your number one show of 2016?
The upset. Stranger Things.
Oh, okay. Number four on my list.
I loved it. I thought it was outstanding. It was fun. I kind of going back to some of the things we've mentioned earlier, it was condensed. It was, you know, eight episodes, I think.
Yes, the Duffer brothers knew exactly how to time this thing out.
Stealing some of the British television style.
That's right. Shorter series.
You don't need a 15 episode season. You don't need it to be two 15 episode seasons, Walking Dead.
Well, we don't thank you. We don't need the Barb flashback episode. We got enough in that they fell in love with her character because of what we saw.
And each episode felt like it was worth, you know, no episode felt like it was setting up. Like you said, there's no flashback. There's no, hey, let's use this episode to move people around and get them in place.
Yeah.
Each episode was moving the plot forward. It balanced while I was, I'm a little too young to remember a lot of the 80s nostalgia. I was, you know, born in the 80s.
But you still watched it when you were a kid. You watched E.T. and the Goonies and Close Encounters and things like that. I mean, we all enjoyed those.
And, you know, it balanced the nostalgia, you know, obviously it was just appealing to that. But then the comedy was great. And what really sold it for me was how heartfelt a lot of those scenes were, especially the finale.
With the kids, too. With young actors, teens and preteens.
It's on my notes right there in front of me. Largely kid cast still pulled it off. Honestly, I went back and I rewatched the finale scene when the sheriff is in the Upside Down.
Oh, yeah.
And in the music's playing and they're trying to revive him. And I mean, I just thought that scene.
It's amazing what music can do for a show.
Oh, it sold it. I mean, right there, I thought that locked it in for me. As you know, I don't know whether it's truly a better show than Atlanta. I thought it was outstanding. I loved it. I watched it all in almost a day. I did pour over the next day over the summer.
All right, Fern. We've taken a peek at the schedule. Let's say you had your choice of front row tickets on the 50-yard line for one game, non-playoff or bowl game, all season. What's your choice?
I'm excited about all the games, but one sticks out to me because it's an early game, and that's the Virginia Tech-West Virginia game. I absolutely hate both teams, so either one can lose, and I'll be happy with it. Regardless, expect a lot of good camouflage outfits out there. A lot of guys that sit in tree stands. A lot of PBR. Would love to go to that game.
We're going to call that the Battery Bowl because West Virginia is known for throwing batteries at the tunnel, and Virginia Tech fans just need to get a clue, okay? You're just not what you used to be, okay? It's just not working. Well, I got to tell you, I'm going to go a little chalk. October 28th, which means we might see some really inappropriate costumes, the horseshoe, Penn State, Ohio State. Penn State stole that game last year in Happy Valley. It's time to see what Trace McSorley, Saquon Barkley have. It's time to see who JT Barrett really is. Urban Meyer in the regular season, it's hard, but if Penn State and James Franklin are going to make the leap, it's going to be that game. And finally, you got to find that sleeper game, and it is Wyoming-Boise State, October 7th. Josh Allen, quarterback, Wyoming. They stunned number 13 Boise State. They cost them the at-large pick. You know, to get into one of those New Year's Day bowls, 30-28 last year, you need to watch Josh Allen because if your team stinks this year, you might be drafting him. Boise State's always worth a watch. It's a primetime watch. We know Jimmy Wright's going to keep us up late to watch Pac-10 football. So if you're going to do that, why not join the Mountain West and get a hell of a matchup? Public Enemy, don't believe the hype because it might not be true. Fern, what is one program in college football that you just don't understand the love they get year in and year out? They're overrated. They're overstated. Who is it?
That's not me.
If you didn't pick that up, Jimmy said the Ohio State University. No.
I'm not taking Ohio State. But I am going to say the Texas Longhorns are a team that get a lot of publicity. 7 straight years without 10 wins. They're 4-10 against Oklahoma and Oklahoma State. 3 straight years with a losing season. The burnt orange is just not what they used to be. I think they're falling off. Mack Brown leaving just crushed them. They got to figure something out.
Mack Brown being forced out.
What have they done since?
You're right.
Get a lot of hype, though. I mean, they're always on TV. Everybody always talks about them. Just not the program it used to be.
We all remember what the national media did when Texas beat Notre Dame last year. And everybody started talking Texas. They are a ridiculous Vegas prop bet to get to the playoff.
It's insane.
I like Tom Herman as much as the next guy. Shane Buechele's a talented guy. They've got a great running back.
Speaking of the price needing to be right, the quarterback position over the years, especially in one quarterback leagues, has become wait. You know, if you're not going to make a move for an Aaron Rodgers, maybe a Drew Brees, wait. Is Marcus Mariota ready to become the guy that you wait for? Is he ready to become a star top 10 fantasy quarterback, a guy that you can depend on week to week and all season long?
Absolutely. I without hesitation there. I really, really like him to make an impact again this year. The Titans went out. They added Eric Decker. They drafted my man Corey Davis, row the boat. Go alongside with Rishard Matthews, who had quietly a really solid season, almost 1,000 yards, 9 TDs last year for Rishard Matthews, and they had Delanie Walker at tight end. They surrounded Marcus Mariota with a lot of weapons. He was among the 10th most consistent fantasy passers last year. Crossed 20-point mark, 9 of 15 games. He broke his leg in Week 16. Also one of the only QBs with at least 4 games of 30-plus points. More than guys like Andrew Luck, Kirk Cousins, Dak Prescott. I would draft him confidently in the 8th or 9th round.
Top of your head, who would you draft first, Mariota or Jameis Winston?
Marcus Mariota.
The Mayweather-McGregor fight is more spectacle than anything else. It's almost like a Super Bowl. You forget that there's a game actually going on. Most true fight fans are salivating over one date. September 16th, Las Vegas, Gennady Golovkin, Triple G, versus Canelo Alvarez. We need to spend some time on this. First off, why is this fight so important for boxing and enticing to fight game fans?
Well, I think it's important because it's going to be on pay-per-view and it can help take away some of the stink of some of the major pay-per-view fights that ended up being stinkers, i.e. Pacquiao, Mayweather, and even most recently for Canelo, his fight against Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. That fight sold a million pay-per-views. It's not Canelo's fault that Chavez forgot how to fight in that match, but they need an exciting match on pay-per-view that's high profile to get more interest back in the pay-per-view market, which is kind of dying right now in boxing, and that's why you're seeing promoters like Bob Arum of Top Rank start having a lot of his big-name fighters fight on ESPN to give them big-name recognition and give them a chance to grow them into pay-per-view stars once again. But this type of fight will keep people interested in potential pay-per-view fights when you have two superstars like you have in this fight facing one another.
Let the average fan know, what makes Triple G so special and what might a victory in this fight mean for him?
Well, I hate to go back to using the Mike Tyson reference again, but he's the more technically skilled Mike Tyson at the middleweight division. He had a streak of over 20 consecutive knockouts before he went to a decision against Daniel Jacobs.
Hell of a fight.
A great fight. Triple G is a Olympic silver medalist. So a lot of people, if you look on the boards, talk about, oh, he doesn't know how to box. He's a power puncher. You don't win an Olympic silver medal without knowing how to box. It's just that simple. And he's now undefeated as a pro, over 90% knockout percentage in his fights, but can kill you with technique, can jab you to death like he did against David Lemieux. And that's why he's become a big star. He's polarizing. He has that kind of delightful smile, if you want to call it, that you don't think he's going to be vicious, but when he gets in that ring, it's a totally different ball game. So he's great with the media, especially because he can speak English at least to a moderate level. And when he gets in the ring, he's a killer. And that's the kind of fighting style that attracts the non-hardcore fan.
New York City has completely embraced him. Let's look at the opposite side. What is it about Canelo Alvarez, who has now finally put his stamp over Chavez? It was already there, but now it's official. He is the next Mexican great fighter. What makes Alvarez special, and what could he benefit from a victory over a name, an undefeated name like Triple G?
Well, the big thing for him being Mexican is that the Mexican fan base is probably the most diehard fan base in all of boxing. So he will always sell well on pay-per-view, at least in that 300,000 to 400,000 buy range, if he fights a nobody like he did when he fought Liam Smith. But when he fights a bigger name fighter, he's looking at 800 to a million, 800,000 to a million buys. And when he fights a megastar like Triple G, you're looking at hopefully greater than that if the McGregor-Mayweather garbage fight doesn't take away fans' interest from that fight. But Canelo Alvarez is right now entering his prime. He's there right now. I think he's 26 years old. Triple G is on the backside of his prime at 35. I would argue that they're both in their prime right now, but I think it's the right time for this fight. Canelo has matured as a fighter. A lot of fans will remember his fight against Mayweather,
but I believe he was 22 or 23 years old when he took that fight. That was about 3 years too early. He wasn't ready for that type of fight. He's ready now. And whereas this fight a year ago would have been probably favored quite heavily in Triple G's favor, at this juncture, I believe a lot of people think it's a 50-50 fight.
If either of these men can have a resounding knockout or just a slugged out victory, could they go number one pound for pound, or is that reserved for somebody else for you?
No, I think right now it's Andre Ward's going to keep that distinction for a little while and then probably eventually be taken over by a Terrence Crawford or a Lomachenko. Both guys are fantastic, but I think they'll be in the top 3 to 4 conversation. But we need to remember that Andre Ward is also undefeated. He's an Olympic gold medalist, and he not only beat Sergey Kovalev, who was a top 5 pound-for-pound fighter at the time, he finished him. And Andre Ward is not known as being a knockout fighter. He's also won the Super 6. So I think he will stay at number one until he loses or he retires, whichever happens first.
Let's continue with that basic movie training. We're going to talk 2012. We're going to talk a film that I did not see until a few weeks ago, End of Watch. IMDb, look at this number, 7.7. Rotten Tomatoes, 85%. Metacritic, it's tough, 68%. End of Watch is a movie that you were excited that I hadn't seen, and I was texting you throughout watching it because I was so into it, and Heather was just entranced by it. By the end, she was bawling at how emotionally gripping this movie was. Why do people need to check out 2012? Thrilling End of Watch.
This movie, it's written and directed by David Ayer, who I guess most recently people may think of Suicide Squad.
Please think of Fury, which is one of the most underrated World War II movies in the last millennium.
It's done some really underrated, really great ones too, like Street Kings with Keanu Reeves.
Maybe my favorite Keanu Reeves movie.
Yeah, Harsh Times with Christian Bale. And then he wrote the screenplay for Fast and the Furious and Training Day.
U-571, SWAT, which I actually liked with Colin Farrell and Jeremy Renner.
So if you take Suicide Squad off his resume, like it's...
That was the studio's fault.
It's stellar. But this is just a dark and gritty, similar to Hell or High Water. It's very realistic story of two partners in LA, South Central, like one of the dirtiest, busiest, toughest parts of the country, basically. And you got Jake Gyllenhaal as Mike Taylor, and you got Michael Pena as the other partner, who's Mike Zavala. And they clearly you can tell that they've been partners for a while. They're partners and best friends. But I think one of the reasons this movie is so good is how it's filmed. You go from the standard action scenes of like the angles and everything, you'll see, but then they also have cameras on their chest and they'll put them on the guns. It's so really it goes cool, from realistic.
It's a cool built-in story. Gyllenhaal as a cop is also like in a college sort of adjunct course, and like he's filming this. So
class
it's kind
or
of
something
like this, like pirate filming. It's that Paul Greengrass handheld camera that can get shaky at times, but it's like the first person first shooter perspective.
Yeah, and when even the first like 5-10 minutes of the movie, there's a police chase that it almost looks like they just pulled it from an episode of Cops.
Yeah, it's almost like Lenny with Grand Theft Auto.
It looks so real. It's kind of amazing they actually did that on their own, because it's nothing but the angle of the cop or the car in the front and then the action scene afterwards.
And these aren't dirty cops. These are cops that are aggressive. They're cocky, but they want to make a difference and they want people to know that we're in charge. There are also a lot of scenes in which they're working with the people around them, and they seem to have the respect of many, even criminals around the area.
I feel like cops in this area are drastically different than like your normal everyday cops, because these people, they say in the movie, they pull out their guns maybe two or three times a shift, and which is probably more than a lot of these cops doing an entire career.
Yes.
Because, I mean, there's a black street gang. I don't know if it's the Bloods or the Crips that's represented in the movie. And then there's one Mexican street gang. It's called the Curbside.
Which is like a very violent take on the Latin Kings, as if they weren't violent enough.
Or MS-13?
Yes.
It's like kind of like a take on that.
And women in these gangs, and they don't come off as parodies. A lot of these are actually former gang members, believe it or not. It's amazing that Hollywood has reached out to this sort of, you've left this culture, but you have so much to teach us about it.
Similar situation with one of the gang members, like he's just filming for the heck of it.
Criminal's perspective.
Yeah, so like they're riding in a car to go to a drive-by or something, and they're just like, you see him like getting prepared and shooting the shit. Before then, it's almost the exact opposite of Gyllenhaal filming him. In this movie, Gyllenhaal and Pena stumble across some dealings with, they come across some like murders and some
linked
houses.
To a cartel.
Yeah, it's a make-believe cartel, but it's one of the big ones supposedly in Mexico. And yeah, they stumble across a couple houses, and then all of a sudden, like they're out for him. The gangs are out for him. And that that's kind of where the shit kicks off towards like the end of the movie.
I mean, they're cops being hunted down, and it's known on the streets. One of my favorite scenes early in the movie is Michael Pena shows up, and they're sort of what you think, that sort of stereotypical thug gangster. They basically drop their weapons, get into a fist fight, and by the end of it, Pena wins, arrest the guy, and all of a sudden that guy is sort of like, hey, that cop was cool. You know, he gave me a chance. He didn't use excessive force on me and said when I asked for it. And it's just one of those cool scenes where I think when I saw the trailer, I thought, well, these are just cocky cops going around harassing people. No, they're taking a similar attitude to the people that they're going after. Not backing down, using force when necessary, but also they seem to have an intimate knowledge of what they're dealing with.
When you can tell they've been in this neighborhood for a while, like that gang member ended up helping them out later in the movie.
That's a great scene.
Yeah. And like one of my favorite things in this movie is the relationships. You believe every relationship, I feel like, from obviously Michael Pena and Jake Gyllenhaal, like that partnership, best friend, family events they'll go to, or them just being in the cop car.
It's a bond only those cops could know, that people that risk their lives, almost like soldiers out, you know, in a war. We don't know it because we haven't lived it.
But it's not only that. Anna Kendrick plays Jake Gyllenhaal's girlfriend.
A great 12 minutes in the movie.
Yeah, hardly in like screen time. There's very little, but you believe just how they did those few scenes. You believe that they're in love, like that's a perfect, like, well-off relationship. And it's the same with Michael Pena and his wife.
They almost model the relationship that a cop and his wife have to have to Gyllenhaal and Kendrick. I like that balance.
Yeah, they're like long-term police, like, couple. Like, they've been together for, I don't know, since high school, so like 15 years or something like that.
Great stories with that, too.
Oh, my God.
So many moments of, again, I said it before with Hell or High Water, there's these moments where you forget that these are cops dealing with gangsters, with drug dealers, with homicide.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just guys hanging out and sort of forgetting all of that and shooting the shit with each other, you know, busting each other's balls a little bit.
Well, and they've got great women in this movie too. And not only the ones I just mentioned, but the other two female cops. One's America Ferrera.
Yeah, she was phenomenal. I love her in Superstore. She got famous on Ugly Betty, but she was great in sort of this.
She's a hard ass.
Yeah, and she's got this great level of sarcasm where she can shoot the shit with the guys.
Yeah.
And she can take it as well as she gives it.
I mean, one of the like most grim, like ugliest moments in the movie, when one of the other cops gets in that fight with the big Hispanic guy.
You've got David Harbour, which many of you will know is sort of the lead cop in Stranger Things.
He's
sort of this disjointed from the cop. He's disillusioned. He's been screwed over by the system. He's trying to tell people what the story is. And he's got this Asian rookie who can't
handle
straight.
It. Yeah. And like the second after this scene happens, like the two, America Ferrera and her partner, are literally just like, you know, she wouldn't have lasted. They wouldn't have had. And like, even like her sergeants like.
Had a spinoff movie with those two girls.
He's just like, you're cold, man. I can't handle it. And it's like. They're great. There's a lot of those actors of like, I don't know his name, but I've seen him in a bunch of things. There's a lot of those.
Well,
yeah. It's one of my favorite movies that I feel like people haven't seen. Like, I'll bring it up, be like, oh yeah, I've heard of it. Not many people, I feel like, have seen that movie.
The trailer fooled me. I thought it was going to be campy. I thought it was going to be over the top violence. And it was just so well done. And I got to tell you, the ending, we're not going to give anything away.
Oh.
It rips your guts out, and then it sort of has this moment in which, like, everything sort of comes together perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I've seen a better ending to this type of movie. The last 20 minutes grab you by the chest and then sort of let go slowly. It was unbelievable. Heather was blown away by the last 20 minutes.
Oh, yeah. You're sitting on the edge of your seat because, I mean, it kind of reminded me of that scene in True Detective, that long tracking scene because
it was so pulse pounding.
These guys are cutting through neighborhoods and alleys and houses. It's a long, like 10-15 minute scene, and that it just reminded me of that. And it, like, you literally don't know what could happen. The great camera work, and it came out in 2012, and so I mean, it's one of my favorite movies of the last 5, 6, 7 years. It
blew me away. And David Ayer's a star. He's got an upcoming Netflix film with Will Smith. And Noomi Rapace, the original Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember from Prometheus, it's going to be a big budget Netflix film, and it's supernatural. It's different, and I think Ayer, if he was given the chance to make the Suicide Squad film that he wanted to make, would have been much better. There were parts of Suicide Squad that worked and parts that were just a mess. But I gotta say, if you've had a good enough shot with Ayer with Fury, which I was just blown away by. I mean, come on, the guy got Shia LaBeouf to look great.
Yeah, which is not an easy act to do.
I mean, if you can get LaBeouf, if you can get him to sort of grab the screen, Ayer's a star. Well, we've talked about two gritty, dark movies with a big message. We're gonna go a little light, and we're gonna go to one of the most eccentric directors in Hollywood, a guy that Army's a fan of, and a guy that you all need to start checking out. We're going to talk about Shane Black's The Nice Guys right after our last break.
And the Baker's Dozen save the best for last. Avon Barksdale and Stringer Bell. Together, as part of perhaps TV's finest show in history during its finest season, their showdown in the third season of The Wire was about as good as TV has ever and will ever be. But why not flip the script and see them on the right side of the law, maybe working from the inside? Forget McNulty and Bunk. What about these two taking down crime in Baltimore? It's the reverse fiction story at its absolute finest. Whether it's a parallel universe or just true detective theory, hey, I'm in. I'm sold, and I'm...
What if I told you a catfish almost caught a Heisman?
Catfishing Manti. Manti Te'o was the captain of a resurgent and undefeated Notre Dame football team entering the 2013 national championship game against heavily favored Alabama. What resulted wasn't a surprise, a resounding 42-14 tied win. And yet, much more was lost for Te'o and his reputation in the coming weeks. Enter the world of a modern-day collegiate athlete, being catfished. Or were we the true victims of his hoax?
You're listening to the Baker's Dozen Podcast with River City Clement. What is it you want to do?
Wow, and there it is, the very best we had to offer from Season 4 and this summer's pop-up season right here at the Baker's Dozen Podcast. First question on many of your minds is, will Season 5 start next week? No, I'm not going to make any promises I can't keep when it comes to scheduling the fifth season. But you know, and I know, that there's plenty to talk about, and far too many incredible guests, amazing friends, my beautiful wife. I can't stay away for too long. Which means the best way to keep up with the Baker's Dozen Podcast as we transition into Season 5, look, it's easy. You simply subscribe to the show and you guarantee free and immediate access to all of our content, past, present, and future. We're available wherever you listen to podcasts. iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud. You can just bookmark our page at Podomatic.com. We got you covered. Check the info. We're all over social media, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. We're there. That way, any and all episodes, they're automatically downloaded to your phone seconds after they drop. Can be listened to on a tablet, streaming device, whatever you need. One more time, I want to say thanks for your support the past two seasons, which the schedule hasn't always been firm with. I want to thank my truckload of guests, all of whom are really just great friends of mine. You heard a lot of familiar voices on here because they've been on this show. They care about making this podcast what it is. And they give up a lot of their own free time, often after a long day of work, and they interact with me, and I like to thank you, the listener. It's a real privilege, and I'm really not worthy of it. I really say if I'm a good enough host for the content, the laughs, the incredible time that these guests are giving me. I'm a lucky guy. But I do want to say that I appreciate each and every time somebody gives up their time to spend time with me on this podcast. And no more so than my wife. She is amazing. Couldn't do any of this without her. She's just amazing. Heather, I love you, and thank you for letting me put this podcast together and letting it become a part of who I am and who we are, I like to think. And the good news of Season 5, folks, I promise it's closer than you think. But I'm also looking forward to reflecting on the successes and some of the shortcomings of this past pair of seasons and finding each and every way I can to help improve this show. And if you've got ideas or you want to be a part of that change, all you got to do is let me know. It's that simple. That's the challenge of a podcast. It's what makes it so much fun. You're constantly innovating. You're constantly trying to improve, get better, entertain, enlighten, and focus the conversation to a way that you want to see it. All I'm asking is that you stick with us along the ride. Trust me, it'll be worth your time. And who could have a problem with that? Nobody. That's who. This the finale. My pep talk turned into a pep rally. Don't get involved. Listen what the crystal ball say. Holly, Berry, Hallelujah. Holla back. I'll do ya. Beast. I love bad, 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 my bad, my bro. And yeah, I like the pick up, bro. I love bad, 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 my bro. And yeah, I like the pick up, bro. I broke my back.
What do you mean by that? You broke
my back is broken.
What, a vertebrae or
well,
what portion?
Spinal.